Hi, everybody, and welcome to episode 468 of the Professional Book Nerds podcast presented by Overdrive. This is Adam, joined by Jill. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
Good. I almost just started giggling because we just had a conversation about how you struggle saying numbers when we do the beginning of the podcast, and then I like almost lost it when I was doing the intro. So
I don't know what it is. I don't even remember when it started. I feel like it probably started when we entered the 400s, and for some reason my brain just wants to be like 468. I was like, that's not, this isn't a phone number.
Well, we also discussed, for people who listen to other evergreen podcasts, other evergreen channel podcasts, the podcast kind of channel we belong to, they asked us to make a like a teaser that you hear, you know, lots of times on podcasts when they talk. It's almost like an ad for their podcasts. If you listen to other ones, you'll hear Jill and I struggle through a teaser pretty soon that'll get put up because we can't read scripts, even if we write them ourselves. We're very, very bad at that kind of stuff.
That's accurate. That's accurate.
Yeah. So today, and I'll let you talk about which particular one we're going to do, but we haven't talked about our Professional Book Nerds Reading Challenge in quite some time because pandemic got, you know, that happened. And now there is other stuff to talk about. But we wanted to get back to it. Every year, the last 2 years, we've done a reading challenge. We have a bunch of different reading tasks that you can do that we talked about at the beginning of the year. You can go back to one of our early 400s episodes on our professionalbookings.com and see all the challenges. It's still in August, and there's 12 challenges, so you've got time if you want to start it now. So we're going to do one of those today. And do you want to talk about the one we're going to pick?
Yeah, so we are going to talk about books that were published between 2000 and 2010. And I feel like I remember when we put the list together at the end of last year, we selected that time period because it was like far enough away where you probably hadn't read any of these books in a while, but also not so far away that they were like older classic. I don't remember. We just like randomly were like 2000 to 2010 sounds great.
Yeah. I will be honest. I was like struggling because it's so many. I mean, this is a stupid, obvious thing to say, like so many books come out every year that it was almost overwhelmed by choice. And so I was trying to go back to like my old Goodreads stuff and then find books because then what I started realizing is this is the time when I was in college and grad school and then a little bit beyond. Well, in college, I didn't read any new books because all of my classes were, you know, of course, just like every, you know, literature class. It's like read classic Roman literature or classic French romance. And it's like there's very few modern day literature classes that you would do. So,
Well, maybe for you.
Well, that's what I was just going to say. When I went into our shared doc for this morning to find mine, I was like, I wonder if have Jill had any struggle?
And
like
no struggle. No
struggle
here. Your
list was just right there, just like waiting. And I was like, shoot.
I had to like take stuff off because I was like, I could put 20 books on here if I wanted. And I didn't want to pick books. Like there were some that I almost put on, but they're books that I've like talked about a whole bunch over the year or like since we've been doing this podcast. So I wanted to not do those. So
yeah, I kind of did the same. So we will put all the books in the show notes so you don't need to write them down like always. And if you want some additional recommendations for this or any other challenge, you can always email us at professionalbooknerds@overdrive.com, or you can tweet or Instagram message us at ProBookNerds. Maybe Twitter more often than I don't really check our Instagram direct messages all that frequently, and I don't know that I get notifications. Maybe just tweet at them.
History is complicated. The story of human progress is long, messy, and riddled with controversies big and small. On Conflicted, we dive headfirst into history's most infamous events and contentious figures. We try and untangle the good from the bad, the fact from the fiction, and the monsters from the misunderstood. Was Genghis Khan a murderous butcher or a civic pioneer? Did the Allied powers go too far in firebombing the German city of Dresden at the twilight of World War II? And how did the Marquis de Sade acquire such a sinister reputation? And was any of it true? These are just a few of the tough questions we wrestle with and investigate on Conflicted. So if you love history or just enjoy a good story, please join me, your host, Zach Cornwell, for a fascinating new topic each and every month. Conflicted, a History podcast, is available on Spotify, Apple, or wherever else you get your podcasts. I hope to see you soon.
You have one more than I did, because I literally, like, I was just out at six. So, do you want to kick us off?
Sure. So, I'm going to start with, now I have to be like, which one do I want to start with? Okay. I'm going to start with Oryx and Crake by Margaret Atwood, which is, okay, y'all know I'm a big Margaret Atwood fan. This has come up often, often in the show. I'm a big Margaret Atwood fan. This is my favorite Margaret Atwood book. Of all of her books, I feel like I've read like 95% of them. I love this book so much. So this is, admittedly, it's going to be, if you are someone who likes to lean into things, this is the book for you during this current time right now. If you are not someone who likes to lean in on things, maybe don't read this one for the challenge. But Oryx and Crake, we start with a character, his nickname is Snowman, and we eventually learn his name is Jimmy. And Jimmy is living in a world right now where he seems to be the last human on the entire planet, save for a unique group of creatures. Creatures isn't quite the right word, but these creatures, humanoids known as the Children of Crake. Crake was Jimmy's best friend, and way back, and Crake had basically set like a plague on the world. And Jimmy is sort of left taking care of the aftermath, and these Children of Crake had survived. And it's just, oh God, it's so good. And it's one of those books when you read it, so it came out in 2004, and, you know, Margaret Atwood has often shied away from the term science fiction and considers herself more of a speculative fiction writer, in that she kind of looks ahead and sort of predicts, possibly not predicts, but sort of looks ahead and bees like, and says like, this is a reasonable place where we could be mm-hmm. in the future. Like, you look at The Handmaid's Tale, which is written 30 years ago, and it's a little weird when you look at where we are now. And Oryx and Crake, a lot of the things that come up in Oryx and Crake, in terms of the science, behind not just the plague, but, you know, like other things. There's like this whole thing with like video games that Jimmy and Crake play, and like YouTube type stuff. And it's just, it's utterly just so, it's so good. But again, like, if you're not someone who really wants to lean into things, mm-hmm. maybe not read this one. It is the first in what ended up being a trilogy. It's the Mad Atom series. That's Mad Atom, both 2Ds. And you sort of find out, well, it doesn't matter. I won't spoil anything. So anyway, that's Oryx and Crake.
Yeah. Sticking with authors that we've talked a fair amount about on our podcast. My first one is by Wendell Berry. It's called Andy Catlett. I think like the last three Augusts I've talked about Wendell Berry. As Jill and I have both discussed, I'm a very cyclical reader. Like, I read specific types of books during specific times of year. We joked during our August preview episode that I have ushered in pre-spooky season, which is true. I am reading a bunch of horror, but also during this time of year in August, I get like super nostalgic, and I don't know why. And I love the idea of like American pastoral type books, and like books set on farms and like simpler times. And I think a lot of it has to do is like this time of year always reminds me of like harvest and coming into autumn and like going back to school and all this stuff. So Andy Catlett is one of Wendell Berry's books that are set in Port William, which is a fictional, small kind of like country type of a town in like the Kentucky area. But he has all these stories, and you can read them in really any order. There is, like, if you Google Port William Wendell Berry book order, like, there is a way that you can read them in a specific way where you'll be introduced to characters that then show up randomly later on. But it's not super important. You can kind of read them anytime you really want. And it's just, like, there's fun little Easter eggs where you'll see, like, oh, that's Nathan Coulter. There was a book called that, and he's in this book randomly. But Andy Catlett is a really, really good one, especially if you are feeling nostalgic, because it's all about this character, Andy, who goes on a bus trip to visit his grandparents in Port William when he's 9. And it's, like, his first kind of step into manhood is sort of how it's described. Is like, it's this experience of his solitary voyage, which, thinking back to it now, like, sending a 9-year-old on a bus completely by themselves is a wild thing that you wouldn't do nowadays. But it's him looking back 50 years later on all of the people that he met for the first time and how life used to be. And now he's looking at, like, how modern life is really, like, crowding in on everyone. And it's just thinking about all these stories, and, like, all of the books in Port William, in the Port William series, I've joked and said in the past, like, they're really low stakes. Like, you know, you're talking about a virus overtaking. I feel like a lot of the books I've been reading lately as well, like, there's these, like, massive implications of things that are happening. And, like, the ones that take place in Port William are just, like, someone is no longer friends with someone who they were friends with when they were younger on the farm, or, like, you know, somebody is trying to make a deal to get their cotton, like, their wool and their cotton from their farm to get a better price for it. And it's just, like, just really, like, simple stories, but you just have this, it's like a warm blanket, like, these conversations that these characters have with each other. And everything that Wendell Berry writes is very based in nature. He's a naturalist, so he writes both fiction and nonfiction, and a lot of them has to do with, like, the Midwest and that type of being a farmer and being on farmland. So Andy Catlett is a really nice one to start with, and again, then you're going to fall in love with the whole Port William series. And they're all really short. Like, if you listen to the audiobooks, they're like 7 or 8 hours each, so you can kind of rip through them, which is great.
My next one is The Time Traveler's Wife by Audrey Niffenegger. Oh, guys, this book like broke me the first time I read it, because it's just, it's so good. And it's one of those books, like, every time I go back and reread it, I feel differently about it. Or I guess, like, yeah, not in a bad way, but just, you know, you pick up things differently or you interpret things differently. So this is about a couple, Claire and Henry. Claire is, actually, we'll start with Henry. Henry was born with a chromosome disorder. That means he's a time traveler. And it's not like a choice. He can't necessarily choose where or when he goes. He's just sort of, like, spontaneously disappears from time and ends up somewhere else. And when he's in his 30s, he's 36, he ends up in a meadow and he meets a 6-year-old named Claire. And so Claire is living her life chronologically, the way us normal folks do who don't have this chromosome disorder. She's living her life chronologically, and Henry sort of keeps popping in and out over the course of her life. But because of how his thing works, you know, he doesn't meet Claire until he's 36, but Claire runs into him when she's like 15 or something like that. You know, like, it's just the way it all works is kind of hilarious in a way. And so this is just sort of about their relationship and the fact that, you know, she knows things that he doesn't know yet in terms of things that have happened. And it's just such a good story in general. And it's one of those books where I've always sort of loved the title, because it's called The Time Traveler's Wife. And you read it though, and you think it's kind of about Henry, but it's not. You know, it's about his wife, but also she's just sort of relegated to being the time traveler's wife. Mm-hmm. It's just, I don't know, it's layered. But it's so good. And I think I mentioned this but in Doctor Who world, there's a character named River Song, and she and the Doctor meet at a time when he has no idea who she is. But she knows exactly who she is. He is, and has clearly known him for a while. And I remember reading that Stephen Moffat sort of got the idea for that from the Time Traveler's Wife, which I love. So, yeah, it's so good. But it's, yeah, the ending kind of broke me, just as a full warning.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely not, it's a sad book for sure, yeah.
But like, there are things where, even though I have read it multiple, there's like one thing in particular where, I should say, like, you know, I say Henry meets her when she's 36, he's 36, that's not necessarily true. They, you know, when she gets older, she runs into him when they're like in their 20s and he has no idea who she is, but she has known him for her entire life, basically.
Right.
And they get married and all that stuff. But there's a thing that happens in her past that is sort of hinted about a lot. And Henry was there, but Henry doesn't discover it until he's like much, much older. And he happens to like time travel back to it. And it's just this moment in this book that every time I know it's coming and it still is just, it still always catches me off guard. Yeah, it's just a really lovely book, but it can be a little sad, so.
Yeah. My next one is Sag Harbor by Colson Whitehead. And as I was putting this list together, I grabbed a couple of books from really well-known authors who maybe you haven't discovered, because, you know, Colson Whitehead, this was a best-selling book, but it wasn't like Colson Whitehead became like all caps Colson Whitehead when he wrote The Underground Railroad. And, you know, now there's the Nickel Boys and he's a 2-time Pulitzer Prize winner. But I feel like, I don't know, I tend to not do this with books where like if I discover an author later in their career, just because there's so many books that come out, I don't always go back and like reread some of their old stuff. Whereas I will with music, like if I hear a band, I'm like, oh, this is really great. And then someone tells me, like, well, they have 3 albums. And I'll go back and I'll listen to them because it's a quicker process. But in case the first thing you ever read by Colson Whitehead was The Underground Railroad, that's okay. But he's been writing books for much, much longer. And Sag Harbor is a kind of coming of age story. I also find during this time of year, again, I think of like, I really enjoyed my high school experience. I had this really tiny high school and we were all really close. I think I've talked about it a little bit. I was the last graduating class in this school. Like it closed, but something happened. We're all still really, really close to each other. So I still think fondly about like beginning of school years, even though the school year is going to be wildly different. So that's why I was thinking about this book. There's this main character named Benji who he's one of like the few black students at this elite prep school in Manhattan. But then every summer he goes to Sag Harbor, where there is this small community of African-American people who have kind of made this world. And it's in the mid-80s. And every time he goes, he has to like relearn kind of what it feels means to be a member of like the black community. Like there's handshakes and there's new like profanity that he has to learn, just like every single teenager has to learn how to swear, of course. It's a very important part of being a teenager. But it's just this, again, it's like this kind of coming of age story where he's experiencing things in learning to come into his own while also learning to be a part of this community that throughout most of the year he really doesn't feel connected to. So it's really funny, but it's also really sweet. And yeah, it's a very feel good book, especially this time of year. So that's Sag Harbor by Colson Whitehead.
The next one is The Historian by Elizabeth Kostova. Longtime listeners are well aware that way back when, I actually looked it up, it was episode number 93.
Oof.
Way back when Adam was at, I don't even remember what trade show, and got to meet Elizabeth Kostova, and I made sure to give him my copy of The Historian.
Oh my god, that's right. I completely forgot about this.
Oh yeah. Oh, I was so jealous. I was so jealous. I feel like we don't get jealous of the people each other gets to interview very often. I was so jealous that he got to interview Elizabeth Kostova. Anyway, so The Historian is about a young woman who comes across an ancient book and the selection of letters. And the letters are all addressed to my dear and unfortunate successor, which is always a great way to start a story. And they sort of, through these letters, she's kind of plunged into this world of her father's secret past and her mother's fate. And they provide, these letters provide a link to sort of trying to figure out the truth about Vlad the Impaler, who of course was the basis for the legend of Dracula. And it's just, it's so good.
It's so good. That book is incredible. It is such a good book.
It is so good. And you know, she's in like Eastern Europe, and I should say this isn't like super contemporary, the time period it takes place. So she's in like these like dusty libraries in the basement of these like centuries old buildings trying to find out the truth about Vlad the Impaler. And also like her family and how her family is connected to all of this. And it's just, it's the fact that it's a debut, it's just it's amazing.
I'm going back and I'm rereading that. I literally,
yeah,
I feel like I need to.
It's been a while.
I was just thinking of that episode and I was like, oh my God, we did talk about all those things. Cause that was for, she had a book that came out called The Shadowland, which was really good as well. But yeah, The Historian is just, it's so good. Man, I'm like shook now. Okay, my next one is The Monstromologist by Rick Yancey. Rick Yancey did The Fifth Wave, which is really well known, but the Monstromologist is, it's the beginning of a series, and it is very unique. It is definitely, talking about pre-spooky season, it is definitely a good young adult, like, horror fantasy. It's about a monster-hunting doctor and his apprentice, so very much has that, I feel like that's sort of a trope that takes place a lot in horror, where, like, there is a apprentice who is learning things and the person that he's learning from is not telling him the full story on everything that's going on. Like, I feel like that happens a lot in horror. And this is told through, actually, this would kind of work in non-traditionally formatted books too, because it is sort of told through a diary of Will Henry, who is the apprentice. And they literally go out and they hunt monsters in 19th century New England. And they have, like, people are always coming at all times of night to ask them for their help. And somebody comes in with the body of this girl and the monster that was, like, eating the girl. They're, like, entwined. And so they discover this young monster, which is, like, it's a headless thing, and it feeds through a mouth on its chest. And it's really very, very, I don't want to say graphically written, but it's just, like, one of those horror stories where, like, the way that Rick writes it, you can almost, like, it's very visceral. Like, you can feel the things that he's describing. And so it takes them on this journey to try to stop that type of monster from consuming the world. And then, like, again, it's just gothic, and I've seen it compared to, like, H.P. Lovecraft meets Arthur Conan Doyle, but I don't love throwing H.P. Lovecraft because he's kind of a terrible human, but that's pretty accurate. But yeah, it's a really fun, if you're looking for a horror thing that is young adult-y, which I know can be kind of, there's not a ton of those people always know about, is a great series. And the covers are all, like, really spectacular. So yeah, The Monstromologist by Rick Yancey is really, really fun.
My next one is On Beauty by Zadie Smith. If y'all aren't already reading Zadie Smith, you need to correct that.
What are you doing?
What are you doing with your life if you're not reading Zadie Smith? So On Beauty, I almost said White Teeth because I couldn't decide which one to have. You can read that one too. You can read White Beauty or White Teeth too. So this is On Beauty. I had a really hard time deciding. On Beauty is a story of an interracial family living in the university town of Wellington, Massachusetts, whose misadventures in the culture wars on both sides of the Atlantic serve to skewer everything from family life to political correctness, the combustive collision between the personal and the political, which is just a delightful description of a book. I love everything about Zadie Smith's writing. And seriously, just read everything written by her.
Read everything.
Just read it all. All.
Yes, I completely agree. Speaking of someone else, you should be reading all of their books. Half of a Yellow Sun by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. So she wrote Americana and We Should All Be Feminists. But this is written all about the Biafra War, which was the civil war in Nigeria. And it is a story that I didn't know anything about before I'd read this. But it was this really long and very, very violent war where like hundreds of thousands of people died. And what it does is it tells the story of this civil war through five different characters and their experiences throughout it. So again, much like Zadie Smith, like if you aren't or haven't read anything by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, you really, really need to. And this is a very powerful way to learn about a story that you might not know anything about if you are listening in the United States, where we're recording from. Because again, I think when you see civil wars in different countries, it may be challenging to try to read about them from a historical aspect because, you know, you might not understand the relationships that go on in that area or, you know, the different religious factions. And there's just so much that can take place in a country that you may not be a part of. But this is a approachable way to learn about a very tragic but important thing that took place in Africa. So that's Half of a Yellow Sun by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie.
My next one is The 13th Tale by Diane Setterfield. If you are someone who likes books about books and weird, strange gothic houses, this is the book for you. So this is about a writer in like your 60s or 70s, Vita, who was well known for a collection of short stories, of 12 short stories. And she's at the end of her life and she sort of decides it's time to reveal the truth about sort of her journey, life, whatever. And so she contacts a young biographer named Margaret. And in doing so, Margaret learns there's actually a 13th tale that was not in the collection. But she also discovers there's not only like this like collection of short stories with like a mysterious 13th one. There are two feral twins. That's the word from the description. Feral yep. twins. There's a ghost. There's a topiary garden. There's a weird mysterious mansion. There's like weird cousins. It's just, it's everything if you're looking for that kind of gothic type book. It's a delightful story. And I will say the first time I read it, I listened to the audiobook, not realizing it was the abridged version until I later started actually reading the book a couple years later. I was like, I don't remember any of this because there were entire sections missing from the audiobook because I accidentally got the abridged version. So that was fun.
Can we talk about that for a second? That's like, I know like, we work at a digital book company and I love all of our publishers, but like, do you know why they would make abridged audiobook versions of books that would like leave out whole sections of the story?
My guess is it's a time thing. And I feel like they try to take out things that don't necessarily take away from the book, if that makes sense. Like it reminds me of, this is going to be the most random thing. It reminds me of at the end of reality TV shows, which I watch a lot of, there's always like a little disclaimer about how things have been edited and whatever, but it didn't like affect the episode or like what actually happened on the episode. Uh-huh. My guess is it's a time thing to try and make the book, you know, the Reader's Digest stories or whatever. Yeah. That is my guess. I honestly don't know, but I feel like they've also fallen out of fashion now that audiobooks have become more popular. And you know, maybe that's where like the whole audiobooks are cheating thing comes from. If you're, you know, because there was a time when you had to be very careful about which audiobook you wanted to get, because you could very accidentally, obviously, get the abridged version if you're not paying attention. I'm really not sure, honestly, where abridged comes from, but it is my guess that it's like a time thing to sort of make it easier or more accessible, because you don't have to listen to the whole thing, but you can get the major takeaways from the book, because they're not going to cut anything. Presumably, they're not going to cut anything that somehow changes the story for you.
Maybe it's also from a production standpoint in the past, because like you said, it's less of an issue now because so many audio, I mean, they still do make physical audiobooks, but so many of them are digital now, where it's like maybe it was trying to limit the amount of CDs that they needed to print the audiobooks on, or the, you know, even further back, the tapes kind of thing.
Yeah. Now I'm like, I kind of want to like, oh, look, Book Riot has the history and current decline of abridged audiobooks. Great. Thanks. I'm going to read that this afternoon.
Yeah, exactly. I was just gonna say, we did a deep dive on that. We'll give you guys an update in the upcoming episode. My next one is called Downtown Owl by Chuck Klosterman. I have a love-hate relationship with Chuck Klosterman. I love his writing when it comes to telling stories. I think he can be, and this is going to sound kind of mean, I think he can be pretty smarmy when he's doing commentary on things that are happening in the world. So, like, he is well-known for his music. He's in the musical world. Words are hard. Where he does a lot of commentary on music that comes out, and he's very well versed in that. But I just kind of hate when people get like holier than thou when it comes to reviewing artists, especially when it comes to music. I don't know, it feels very annoying to me. But I love the way he tells stories, and the first one he wrote was Downtown Owl, and it is kind of like Friday Night Lights. Honestly, it's almost like Friday Night Lights meets a Wendell Berry novel. It's set in North Dakota in this town called Owl. And it's just this area. There's this main character named Mitch, and he plays high school football, which is extremely important there. And he's worried about how how weird he is, or maybe not as weird as everyone else. And it's like a coming of age story where it's all these characters that are in this small farm town and learning to grow up together, and it's just this way that how rural communities exist in a certain way that is a little bit of outside of reality for everyone else in the world. And all these characters of different ages come together, and they're unified by this blizzard. And it's just a really interesting story, and it's really fascinating. It's very funny, and it examines kind of what it means to be normal, and the fact that like everyone always says when they're a teenager, or even when you're older, like, I just kind of want to be normal. And it's like, what does that actually mean? Like, is normal an actual thing? And the fact that like you could be the most popular person in a high school, or you could have no friends, or you could be a part of the theater, you know, community, or you could be an athlete or anything in between. And the whole time you're probably thinking internally, like, oh, I wish I was more like these other people. And it's everyone kind of goes through these types of things as you're trying to discover who you are. So Downtown Owl is just a really interesting examination of growing up, and especially growing up particularly in this one space that Chuck is very well known. He knows very well, which is, again, kind of the Midwest, and especially in North Dakota, which is kind of in the middle of nowhere.
Okay, so if you read fantasy, like I read fantasy and like high fantasy, there are two book series that are well known for readers waiting still for a very long time for the next book in the series. The first one is The Winds of Winter from George R. R. Martin for Game of Thrones. And the other one is the third book in the Kingkiller Chronicles series by Patrick Rothfuss, which starts with The Name of the Wind, which is one of my absolute favorite books ever. So The Name of the Wind and its sequel, The Wise Man's Fear, and eventually the third book. So this is about it starts at an inn, and the innkeeper, Kvothe, this like traveler, comes and figures out that he recognizes this innkeeper as sort of a man of legend, who kind of disappeared from society, so to speak, and he convinces Kvothe to tell him his life story about who he is and how he got to be. So Kvothe sort of grew up in a family of troubadours, and then he ends up at this magical university. And I have to say that first, I love the magical university that he attends, because who doesn't? There's like an entire subplot involving the library, which is just delightful. And I talk about the library in an episode I did a while back about my favorite fantasy libraries. But this also has one of the best, if not the best, entrance exam scenes in like pretty much any book when he gets to school and has to sort of, you know, get his way in. It's just, oh my God, it's amazing. I love everything about it. Just everything about it tells you everything you need to know about this character. And this is just one of those books that people love for good reason. And, you know, I know there was like a thing going around last week, was it on the book Twitters about how, well, I guess it happens every like 6 months. Something comes up where, you know, writers don't owe you their next book. And I feel like this particular one was centered on Patrick Rothfuss, although I don't remember why. And then, of course, it happened with George R. R. Martin after the Hugos, and that's a whole other story, but whatever. So
yeah, we could do like a six-episode
on the series. Hugos. We won't talk about that right now. And so, yeah, so we've been waiting. The sequel, The Wise Man's Fear, came out, I think, in 2011. So it's been almost 10 years, and, you know, I'm actually, and I, like, when I read these books, I feel the same way about Game of Thrones. When I read them, would it be great if the book had an ending? Sure, but these stand on their own for me as it is, and I don't actually have, like, I don't feel like it takes away from the book series for me by not having the conclusion. Yeah, it's so good. And it's becoming, is it a TV show? Lin-Manuel Miranda, I think, was involved in something with this, and I don't remember off the top of my head.
But I think what ended up happening last week was somebody started a like a petition.org type of like a thing where it was like, sign this petition to get Patrick Rothfuss to finish his novels, and like everyone else and like all these authors were like, hey, if you're a reader, don't ever do that, because it's not helping anything. And then like I think he did a video, it wasn't last week, but it was like relatively recently, where he was like, feel bad about this, but yes, it's not done yet. But like Blake, you said, it's like, yes, and also don't message or George R. Martin or do anything and be like, you're getting old, you should finish these books before you die. Like, that's not cool. Don't do any of that kind of thing. It's leave them alone. They're creating stuff too, and it's hard. And
like, I feel like it would be really hard to know, you know, like you think about, see, we're going off clearly on a whole tangent
here. That's okay.
But, you know, you're thinking about something like Harry Potter or Twilight, or, you know, like I rage quit Twilight, the last book, because I was so mad. Or I'm undecided on if I'll read Midnight Sun. That's a different conversation. The Hunger Games, you know, like when you have this book series, which has these beloved characters and people get emotionally invested in them, it's, you can't please everybody. Mm-hmm. And as the more time has gone on, you know, you have those people who get upset because you haven't finished it. But also 10 years ago, like Twitter existed, Facebook existed, these things existed, but I feel like you didn't, like the angry fans maybe weren't quite as loud.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so now not only do you have to like finish this book that ties up this series that you've been working on for probably like 2 decades, if not longer, in the course of George R. R. Martin, mm-hmm. So you have to tie it up. You're going to make people mad. You know, you're going to make people mad. Mm-hmm. And those mad fans have a big platform. That's a lot of pressure that I would not want to write under. So I forgive the fact that, you know, there's a lot going on for these authors, and I forgive them taking their time.
Yeah.
For books.
Books are really hard to write, you guys. And especially when there is all that pressure to be like, and also with George R. R. Martin, like he has thrown his characters so far apart from each other, and like he's, I'm sure he's probably like, how do I bring them back?
Yeah, like you can see that in the final season of the show, which had its own problems separate from George R. R. Martin. But you know, these journeys that in the first season took like months for these characters to make, suddenly within like 5 minutes, because you have to bring these characters together somehow. And how do you do that? Well, you just sort of speed up time, and we're just going to pretend that didn't happen.
Like they all have a TARDIS, I think.
They all have a TARDIS, and they can just like get wherever they need to, whenever they need to, like super quick. And yeah, so you have these. Yeah. So I'm okay with, I don't mind writers taking a long time. I know that is a personal thing and others feel differently, but they don't take away the books for me.
Just go read another. Just go start another fantasy series. There's many.
A lot of them that are finished. There are a lot that of them finished. That are complete.
Yeah, go read N.K. Jemisin. She writes a book seemingly like every 3 months. She's a machine, and they're all Hugo Award winners and fabulous. Mm-hmm. Speaking of Hugo Award winners, my last one that I have here. Look at that little tie-in. Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell by Susanna Clarke. This is such a fun book, and I think it became either a movie or a...
It was a TV show,
yeah, which is pretty good. But it's set in the Napoleonic Wars. It's like the early 1800s. And people believe that magic is gone from England until Mr. Norrell, who is like very reclusive, he reveals his powers and he becomes this overnight celebrity. And there's this other practicing magician who's really young, and his name is Jonathan Strange. And he becomes Norrell's pupil, and they join forces to fight in the war against France. It's just it's an incredible story. And, my favorite thing about historical fiction as a genre is how wide ranging it can truly be. Is like, you can do historical fiction where it's like a very realistic set in World War II. And it's just like, all you do is you just kind of change your relationship. Or you can do what Susanna Clarke did and be like, this is based in the Napoleonic Wars. Also, there's magicians, and the magicians fought France. And like, I just love that those are both historical fiction. It makes me so happy. I don't know why. It's like, it can be so wide ranging as long as there's like something kind of realistic that happened. Historical fiction. So yeah, if you like magicians, if you're a fan of, weirdly, it kind of reminds me almost like the Prestige adjacent, like that movie, The Prestige. I don't know why it reminds me of that, but it kind of does. Because there's two different magicians who have very different points of view on things, but they sort of work together, but they're also sort of not working together at all. And it's just very, very interesting. So Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell is a really, really, really great book. It's really fun. And Susanna Clarke is fabulous.
I have a confession. I did not like that book. I didn't even finish it.
Oh, man, I loved it. Oh, this is rare. We don't usually have books where we're... Yeah, she had a book that just came out called Piranesi, I think. But yeah, that's weird.
I have tried reading this book like 5 times. I couldn't get into the TV show. Like, there's a part in the book, like I always get to the same spot. There's a whole thing with like the bride dies or something like that. Like, it's early in the book, and they like bring her back, but it's not quite what they would thought, you know, which is what happens when you mess around with necromancy and all that stuff. And every time I'm just like, I can't get past this part. I like that scene. I like that idea, but I try to keep reading. I'm like, I can't do it. And even in the TV show, that's about the time when I'm just like, you know what? I'm not really feeling this.
So. Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah. All right. My last book is probably my most favorite nonfiction book ever. And that is The Devil in the White City by Eric Larson. Oh man, you guys, this book is just, it is. Okay. First, everything Eric Larson writes is genius. Which we had talked about before.
Yeah.
But The Devil in the White City is about, there's two things happening at the same time. First is Chicago is home to the World's Fair. During like the Gilded Age. And they're building this whole city within Chicago that they're calling the White City. And at the same time, there is a young doctor, Henry Holmes, who is a serial killer.
he super is.
And is sort of adjacent. He has this hotel where he's sort of adjacent to the White City, or the White City. And, you know, these people will travel in and stay at his hotel and then mysteriously die. It's just all true story. All true story. God, it's so good. And it's one of those, I read a lot of nonfiction and I always did, but I think this was sort of the first nonfiction book I read where I saw an author apply fiction writing techniques to the book.
Yeah.
In a way I had never seen that before. It's so good though. It gets a little graphic because Henry Holmes tortures his people that he kills. So there's it's like a little Sweeney Toddy minus the music.
That's so accurate.
It's a little Sweeney Toddy. Yeah, so I feel like Sweeney Todd and that whole idea of this person who presents one face to the outside and then lures people into his business.
Yeah.
And kills them. You will enjoy The Devil in the White City. And just sort of learning about, you know, we don't have world's fairs obviously anymore. And how this idea of the world's fair came to be and how they built this huge city within a city. And you know, there's a lot of things that are created that were created for the World's Fair that we'd never seen before. You know, it's a fair that we'd never, the world had never seen before. Now we are very familiar with them. And it's just, it's a really, really good book, but can get graphic.
A little Sweeney Toddy is how I'm going to start describing things, because that's my favorite description I think I've ever heard.
It's a little Sweeney Toddy.
Yeah, but I know what you mean about using fictional writing, using those techniques. Matthew Desmond, who wrote Evicted, who was on the podcast a couple years ago, he does that, and that's nonfiction. And then another one, which actually technically counts because it was written in 2010, The Poisoner's Handbook by Deborah Blum, which I talked about a bunch. But that's another one where it's in the Jazz Age, and it's all about how people came to be able to use chemistry to detect poisons and murder and stuff. But it's the same thing. It's they use this fictional writing style to tell very true stories. So
also, this has been in Hollywood production hell for 10 years, maybe 20. I think it came out early in the 2000s. And it's, last I heard, it was a Scorsese Leo DiCaprio thing, which I am totally on board for.
But that sounds right. Yeah.
What happens, because it's yeah.
What's his, you know who would be perfect, I feel like, for one of his roles is, and he's retired now. Oh, wow. I'm drawing a complete blank. He was in Gangs of New York and My Left Foot.
Oh, no, I know who you're talking about.
There Will Be Blood.
Yep.
Oh, God. Everyone's just going to be, yelling at me.
They're going to be yelling at you. You can always edit this part out.
I'm just going to keep it in, and I'm going to say, I'm going to look it up real quick, because I can't believe that I'm drawing.
Is Daniel's first name?
Daniel Day-Lewis. Oh, my God. Thank you. Whew. That's going to bother me. Oh, yeah.
You can start over. That's so you can just edit it.
Leaving it. I'm just leaving all this in. But yeah, Devil in the White City, that's very much an Overdrive book. I feel like there's a lot of times when we'll bring someone on who hasn't been on the podcast in a while, and that's one of those books where it'll just come up. We're I just read Devil in the White City. It's House of Leaves or Penny Reed. There's just things that happen here. Okay, those are all of our recommendations. If you want another book that's historical fiction, Big Library just kicked off. And you can go to biglibrary.com and learn more information about the title, which is The Darwin Affair. Or you can listen to our episode from last weekend, which is a bonus episode where Jill and I interviewed Tim Mason, the author. Anything else going on that you...
I don't think so.
Okay, cool. All right, well, I hope you guys enjoyed this episode of the Professional Book Nerds Podcast.
Readers can sample and borrow the titles mentioned in today's episode from overdrive.com, and our library friends can purchase these titles in Marketplace. Professional Book Nerds is proud to be an Evergreen Podcast signature program. To learn about other Evergreen podcasts, visit evergreenpodcasts.com. Our podcast is produced, recorded, and edited by Adam Sokol and Jill Grunewald, and presented by Overdrive. For more information, visit professionalbooknerds.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.